We're back on the Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Happy Baby Friday. Happy December 1. I think it's time to flip into holiday season now. I'm ready.
You're there?
There's a little snow on the road today, a little dusting.
How are those drives in?
It's fine.
Not as exciting anymore?
It's day four. I'm fine with it. Yeah. It's lost.
Its luster.
The luster. Never losing the luster. Jeff Merrick from the Jeff Merrick Show, host of 32 Thoughts Podcast. How's it going?
It's a very tidy transition. Well done, Ailish.
I'm learning from the best. I listen to you every day, and I learn about transitions.
Oh, no, jeez, I'm so bad at them. You know, you'd think, you know, I started like just after Roger Lajoie did on our station. I'm still miserable.
Speaking of Roger Lajoie.
Roger's still awesome. Yes, sir. Ma'am.
He's got his 30th anniversary show on Saturday. What a guy.
I'll tell you, I really have like a soap and warm water feeling for Roger. Like there were a few people, like here comes Grandpa Simpson. You ready for this? So I started at 590 in 1994. You know, I've been fired a couple of times. I've been rehired a couple of times. It's been an interesting dance here with me and this radio station going back to the telemedia days. But there were three people specifically that helped me and George Strombolopoulos and Bob Mackowitz, who all started our careers right around the same time. Elliot was a little bit before us. There was Norm Rumack, who was the late night vampire. He used to take calls after the Maple Leafs games, and you know, he was a monster of the airwaves on 590. Like, he was great with callers. You know, would say outrageous things, like, you know, wouldn't trade Wendell Clark for Sergei Fedorov, like, and just get callers like enraged and engaged. And it was great. Like, sports
sounds
radio
like
was done
JD Bunkus.
a little bit. JD is Norm Rumack version 2.0. But like, this was, you know, sports radio in its infancy in Toronto, and Spider Jones was another one that I think fondly of, and Roger Lajoie as well. And the three things that these people all had in common for me as I gaze at my navel and my career as we celebrate Roger is they helped me a ton. I've never forgot that. And whenever I get a chance to mention them or, you know, elevate them or promote them or do anything around them, you know, keep people thinking about them and how important they were to this radio station back in the early to mid 90s, I always will. And there were so many times that, you know, Roger, like, I'd be doing, like, I was a call screener, right? Sorambo used to work the board, and I was a call screener. You know, Roger Lajoie Show, Sportsnet, or what was it even called? Sportsnet 590, Fan 590 at that point. And would let people on. And if there'd be a dead zone, Roger would always say, just grab your headphones and come on the air. And I had, like, Ailish, Justin, about zero business being on the air. Like, many will maintain I still have zero business being on the air at this radio station, but Roger always went out of his way. Like, it's just like radio dead zone, though, at some of these shows, right? Like, really, really late at night. But still, like, Roger didn't have to put me on. And I'm not the only one, is the point I want to make here. Like, there are countless people that have come through this radio station and gone on to very significant and prominent careers, and a lot of it was started because Roger said, I don't care if you're not ready for this, I don't care if you don't deserve this, grab the headphones and get on, let's work on your chops. I have all day in the world for Roger Lajoie, and, you know, before him, you know, Spider Jones and Norm Rumack and these guys that all helped me. And I'm sure, Justin, Ailish, you have your own Roger Lajoie, and maybe Roger Lajoie is your Roger Lajoie, but, you know, Saturday's going to be special. 30 years at 590, man. That guy's a legend.
I think Roger Lajoie is Ailish's Roger Lajoie.
He was my prof at one time.
So he was teaching then. Now he's teaching professionally.
He gave me an A, so I don't think I earned it, but I'll take it.
His fingerprints all over everything, obviously. And I don't know what the last milestone was, but I remember listening to him on a weekend within the last couple months, I think maybe slightly before I started, and he was talking about, you know, all the old names, all the current names, what everyone's backstory and history and his involvement with them. So I'm sure, I don't know what he has planned for Saturday, but I'm sure it'll be worth listening to.
Yeah, and you know what? And the one thing he's never done is made it about himself. Like, all of this, by the way. Like, and I don't know anyone. Like, he's really thorough and particular. I cannot tell you how many shows I've done or how many times I've been on the air, but Roger can. Like, I can't tell you how many.
No, he's got the exact number. Mm-hmm.
It's insane, right? Because because for Roger, every show is a sort of mini event and needs to be documented and put in a very specific place. And he treats them all like there are no throwaway shows. There's no like, I got to do 3 hours on Saturday afternoon. I'm just going to get through it and then get on with my. No, like, everything is a big event for Roger. And I think that's why he documents all of it.
3,870 shows. 3,870 shows. Yep. He's just so grateful for the opportunity. I love him. He's a wonderful hero. Anyway, let's talk about heroes. Mitch Marner.
Okay.
Yeah, let's talk about a point streak. Most celebrated 18-game point streak you ever seen? That would, like, the guys were really, really happy. And I think our take from this week has been Mitch Marner's confidence, Mitch Marner's happiness, Mitch Marner, the vibe around Mitch Marner is most reflected into the team's vibe. Like, he kind of is the pulse in that sort, in that very specific way. And if he's getting himself a milestone like this, feeling good, smiling on the bench, laughing, doing the gritty in the locker room, like, that's just great stuff for the Toronto Maple Leafs.
And talking about his dog and what his dog, like, it's, you hear Mitch Marner talk about his dog. Yeah, you hear, and it's like, okay, so, like, these are your zen moments then. These are your in-the-moment moments. Like, these are the grounding moments. And listen, I'm a big dog person. Everybody should, if they can, have a dog. I always encourage that. But, you know, it's interesting, Justin. I've thought a lot about this because, like, I agree with you. I think that, you know, they sort of rise and fall with the mood and the performance of Mitch Marner. And I've always wondered, you know, why is that? And the one thing that I keep coming back to is he's from here and he grew up here and people know him here, whether it's through the Maple Leafs or whether it's through the GTHL or playing in the Ontario Hockey League with the London Knights. Like, there's a lot of players, obviously, that's that aren't from Toronto. Has a very international flair, whether it's Sweden, whether it's, you know, Arizona, whether it's, you know, wherever. Now, John Tavares does fit into this equation as well, being from Toronto, well, just outside in Oakville specifically. But, you know, Marner kind of wears it like nobody else. He wears the highs, he wears the lows. And the one thing that I always come back to is, you know, how emotionally draining that must be for Marner. You know, there's a lot of people that, you know, when your team gets criticized, you know, you can shake it off. Or when you get criticized, you can shake it off. I think because Marner's from here, you know, the highs are higher, but also the lows are lower. And Marner's talked a lot about this, you know, in the past, about having just to get away from everything. And I think it's really because he internalizes all of it and takes a lot of it personally and, you know, has a, I don't want to say a hard time, but I think he has a more difficult time than others handling criticism. That's just because he's here and he's, like, that intimately involved. Like, there's not an ironic distance that occurs between Mitch Marner and criticism in Toronto because he's from here. And there's this element of, I can't escape this because I'm from Toronto. I grew up a Maple Leafs fan. And I'm one of the stars on this team right now. You know, other players can physically leave and can abandon the criticism, go back home somewhere else. Marner can't do that. Now, Marner's had chances to go. You know, like, there was that, you know, the offer sheet from the Columbus Blue Jackets that was speculated on when, you know, he was doing his contract extension. And I don't think he had, you know, any serious plans to do that. I think that was sort of a fallback if things really didn't go the way that he wanted. But I think that he knows that this is the right place for him. This one is a place that feels like home for him because it is home. And I think because of it, you know, sometimes criticism can be a dagger. So even when I'm hearing him talk about his dog, like, I get it. Like, I understand it. Like, we all work in Toronto media, and if you think that athletes get it, yes, they do. So do people in the media. Nowhere near what athletes get. But at the same time, like, when you're from here and you're that intimately involved, I think it can't help but sting. And that's why I think that, you know, the emotional pulse of the Toronto Maple Leafs, Justin, I agree with you, like, 1,000,000%. You see in Mitch Marner, when he's feeling it and he's grooving, the Maple Leafs go right along with it. And when he's not, it's trouble time.
And the reality, I think, is that he is just as, maybe even slightly more important than Auston Matthews, really. But Auston Matthews is way more likely to get major accolades, to have the 60-goal mark, to have something that's going to belong on a Hall of Fame plaque. Whereas Marner's, you know, he's going to get 100 points every year most of the time, but he hasn't been there yet. Like, he's still chasing those accolades, and that this one presented itself, I think it meant a lot to everyone because they kind of understand the relationship and where Mitch Marner fits and everything, but also his importance and how that all, like, interacts with one another. It's just, this is why I think it was a big deal.
One of the things, you know, Eilish mentioned transitions a couple of seconds ago as well, and I kind of look at Mitch Marner as being a transition between generations of fans as well. Like, as much as you focus on what Mitch Marner means on the ice, just the way that he plays, I mean, we've all heard the grousing from older school hockey fans, like, enough of this cute stuff. And you mentioned him doing the gritty, like, what is he doing that in practice for? Like, that, I look at him, it's like, well, that's a player that appeals to younger fans. And one of the things that's always, I think, when you have an established franchise like the Toronto Maple Leafs, I know Chicago went through this as well, you're always thinking to yourself, okay, the building is sold out. We have, you know, a lot of season ticket holders certainly here. But where's our next generation of season ticket holder coming from? How can we get, you know, younger fans enthused about our game, and how can we get younger fans enthused about
the gritty post game
hockey team? Well, I'm telling you, Eilish, I think it's true. Like, you don't have to, like, older hockey fans, you don't have to like it, but it doesn't matter. Nobody cares if you like it or not. Because what Mitch Marner does is he is that transition between the established fans right now and the fans that are on the horizon. Both my kids love him. I got a 12-year-old and a 10-year-old. Like, they're crazy for Mitch Marner. Now, mind you, they are crazy about Auston Matthews, but for a whole bunch of, players like Marner, players like, you know, Trevor Zegras, players like, you know, Jack Hughes, like, they make it fun to be a hockey fan. And we spend so much time being so furrowed brow and serious about it. Like, this is Toys R Us here. Like, come on, everybody. Like, I think what Marner does is he reminds us that this is a kid's game, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there's the old story. You know, Ron's talked about this before, and it's one of my favorite things to do at speeches. There's a little boy who goes up to his mom one day and says, "Mom, when I grow up, I want to be a hockey player." And his mom smiles and looks down at her little boy and says, "Son, that's great, but you can't do both." And that one has always resonated with me. And I always try to remind myself that at its heart, this is a young person's game. And we should never lose sight of that. And I think that Marner, like, the one thing that still surprises me about Marner is how has he not become, like, hardened and cynical through all of this?
That's right. Well, he deleted his social media for a while. And, you know, he had to kind of consciously not look into that stuff. But, I mean, he's still fun and vibrant.
Yeah, but still, like, you still hear, you can't escape it. Like, it's in the air in Toronto, all of it. Like, it is the predominant conversation in Toronto, in Toronto sports is the Maple Leafs, and a lot of it always revolves around Marner. I'm just impressed at how people, and Marner's one of them, just refuses to become a completely, you know, cynical and hardened person. I still like to see that, what do we call it, hockey joy in Marner. Like, that, and I hope that never leaves Mitch Marner or anyone from his generation.
His vibes certainly keep the team buzzing, as he put it. But, I mean, goaltending as well. This past month, we set it up. They've had some of the best record, best save percentage. They've been definitely driven by goaltending. What did you make of Samsonov's return, and now the fact that the two Leafs in goal have been really steady, and maybe the surprising storyline so far after the summer of doubt, and running it with these two guys that are kind of question marks.
Yeah, and it's also with a blue line that's significantly dinged up as well, right? Sometimes goaltending is a reflection of the defense in front of you. Well, not so fast. First of all, do you think from the Dubas haters they'll give Dubas any credit for this?
No, unless they win a playoff round.
But right now, like, those, like, you know, Eilish, like, those choices, like, okay, Matt Murray, you know, he can't get the hospital bracelet off. Like, what are the Toronto Maple Leafs doing? Oh, Ilya Samsonov, like, you know, Washington got sick of his act and, you know, kicked him, you know, punted him out the door. He's a, you know, a former high pick, and, you know, he's a flop. It's not gonna work out here. Like, was it a gamble by Dubas? Absolutely. But so far, here we are just past the quarter mark of the season, and it's worked out splendidly. And even one other thing you should point out, too, I think we should point out, is, you know, now it's back to Murray and Samsonov. Eric Shellgren did a great job. Like, normally, you look at American Hockey League goaltenders when they come up, you can always count on the one bad goal per game. Like, you can take it to the bank. And that's what made, you know, Jordan Binnington a freak going back to 2019, is you didn't get that one bad goal a game. But normally with AHL goalies, you bank on at least one bad goal. And there were some games where there was the one bad goal. But overall, like, it didn't become a trend. with Eric Sjallgren. And I think that now everyone, you know, Leafs fans are certainly, you know, basking in the euphoria of how well Murray's playing, how well Samsonov is playing. I don't think Leafs fans should forget here just how much heavy lifting Eric Sjallgren did, because, you know, being a starting goaltender is tough. Being a starting goaltender in the NHL, I've always maintained, Ailish, that the two hardest jobs in Canada, number one is prime minister, and number two is starting goaltender for any Canadian NHL team. Like, those are the two hardest jobs in this country. And, you know, Sjallgren got, you know, rushed into his position, and I think he did great. Like, really, I'm with you. Like, one of the great stories is how this Leafs team was able to do it, you know, put this streak together and put this, you know, this rebound in November together with a blue line that has been decimated and with their two starting goaltenders both out.
So, Merrick, I heard you on with Greg Wyshynski yesterday, and everyone should check out Merrick versus Wyshynski on Wednesdays, because it's definitely goofy. Worth a listen. It is goofy, and I want to bring up one of your goofy takes, which is the idea that, actually, no, I'm going to present my own, because but it's in the spirit of your take yesterday that maybe goalies shouldn't be able to freeze the puck. But I think the Leafs, I think the Leafs should be better off if they went with 11-7, 11 forwards, 7-D. And part of it is watching Mac Hollowell and looking at him and being like, okay, that's not going to work in the postseason. Like, it's not. But it's valuable. Mm-hmm. Like, he's got some valuable skills. His setup on Austin Matthews' goal was something that you're not going to get out of certain defensemen. So if you do have seven defenders, if you have a more fluid pairing system, if some are for the power play and four-on-four scenarios or sheltered minutes and others are for the penalty kill and logging difficult minutes against top competition, wouldn't you be better off, and especially, and not that the depth has been an issue with the Maple Leafs this year, but with the Malgins of the world in the lineup and searching for that 12th forward, wouldn't you be better off just giving a couple more seconds to Mitch and Austin and Willie and whoever else is playing well that night? I feel like you could optimize the Leafs a little bit more if you put more defensemen out there on the ice.
I think one of the concerns is probably getting enough of those players, you know, getting their skates on the ice and getting the puck on their stick and getting them enough touches so they're still in the game. Like, I always wonder about coaches, you know, right away, you guys have seen this a million times, right away you want to get all your lines out there real quick to start the game just to make sure everyone gets a touch and everyone gets their blades on the ice and everyone's involved in the game and, you know, can get into it. The last thing you want to do is have someone, you know, just sitting there watching the game, like, should I just put a baseball hat on here? Like, should I put my skates? These skates are tight. Can I loosen them a little bit? Can I untie? That would be one of the concerns. But I don't disagree with you. Like, I've always wondered about, I've always wondered about, you know, open rosters just to begin with and having, you know, more specialists on the bench, not just for penalty kill or for power play, but also for shootout. As well, like, have these players available. So I'm not against it. I just know that it tends to be tougher when you go the 11-7. But Justin, I'll listen to that all day long, especially when you see someone like Mac Hollowell, who has a very unique skill set and one that, like, bang on. Like, how many young players make that play that we saw yesterday to Austin Matthews? Like, I know it's more than a handful, but still, like, that's a really confident play for a young defenseman, don't you think?
Definitely.
Like, when you think about, like, the entire Mac Hollowell story, too, like, man, that is for a young guy in Toronto on a Wednesday night in a packed house, make that play. Like, he has a very unique skill set. Like, I'll listen to that one all day long. My only, I know that it's not ideal for teams, and by that I mean not ideal for coaches, but I'll listen to all of that talk. I love the idea of specialized players for specialized situations. I'll take that all day long.
Speaking of unique skill sets, Alexander Ovechkin passed Wayne Gretzky for career road goals. My only take from this, because we're still pretty couple years away here from him passing Gretzky overall, was Wayne's just slacking on the road back in the day?
Okay, how should I say this? The Oilers of that era really enjoyed themselves.
I thought there might be a reason.
I don't know. I'm fishing for a reason here. I'll tell you what. You know, one of the things that I think we're going to see from the Washington Capitals is, and because, listen, aging curves are real and teams eventually fall off the cliff. I get it. But, you know, Washington is unique because eventually this is a team that's going to, you know, turn itself as they continue to sort of trend downward and outside of the playoff picture in the Metropolitan Division. I don't think it's a team that, you know, until Ovechkin catches his record, is going to go through any kind of rebuild. Like, when you think, like, eventually this team's going to turn itself into get Ovechkin the record. Like, that's what it's all going to be built around. So I don't think that the Washington Capitals are going to look at this and say, well, we've been outside of the playoff picture now for, you know, two or three seasons in a row. It's time to tear this thing down. Like, they're still going to go out there and they're going to be active in free agency. They're going to be active in trades just to surround Alex Ovechkin with players that help get him that record. And I don't think we're ever, as long as, you know, that record still stands by Gretzky, I don't think we're going to see the Capitals say, you know what, it's time that we got in the Connor Bedard sweepstakes or whatever. I still think it's going to be a team that for the next few, and it may feel awkward. Like guys, the, you know, as Hockey Op says, like, you know, the smart thing to do here is, you know, begin the rebuild, begin that transition to the next wave of what the Washington Capitals are going to be. To me, this is just going to be a team that, you know, yes, playoffs would be nice, but we really need to get Ovechkin that record.
Quickly here, last one for you, Jeff. Just a quick word on Chris Letang, and obviously the really unfortunate news that he's out indefinitely after suffering his second stroke in less than a decade. I know it's early. This just happened yesterday, but any idea or thoughts on just the next steps on how you navigate something of this sort?
So things in situations like this, I turn to someone by the name of Dr. Ali Rendley, who works at University Hospital Network Toronto Rehab. She actually used to work with us at Hockey Night in Canada until she smartly said, yeah, you know what, hockey media, that's for suckers. I'm going to be a doctor. And she did it. So I always defer to Ali and asked her sort of, you know, what happens here? Like, what happens in this situation? And she texted me last night and said, you know, it sort of depends on the size and the location of the clot. Like you rightfully mentioned, he did go through a situation like this in 2014 where they found a small hole in his heart. Depending on the size and the location, and the treatment could either be blood thinners or it could be an actual procedure to remove the clot itself. So maybe a heart procedure to close the hole. I don't know what they're planning to do. I know that if it's blood thinners, I would imagine he would be out longer than the 2 months that he was out previous in 2014. But as of right now, I don't know that Pittsburgh has announced that they're what the plan is going to be for Chris Letang. I just don't expect to see him anytime soon. We just hope that his health is well enough for his quality of life, and two, you know, good enough that we can see him again this season. Because I think one of the great stories in this offseason was that the Penguins kept the band together.
That's right.
Like, they're taking another shot at this thing, like Letang and Malkin and Rust, and like we're taking another swing or a couple of more swings at this thing. And you don't want to see anyone, mainly for their own health and their family, but two, for hockey, take themselves out of the lineup because of health issues. So we hope that he's fine, that it all works out, that he has a great quality of life, whatever the procedure ends up being, if it is a heart procedure or they just do blood thinners, because selfishly I want to see the Penguins take one more shot at this thing and a few more shots at this thing, and I want to see him do it with Chris Letang.
Of course, and it was great to hear that they sound optimistic, him and the organization, and hopefully takes the time he needs, and we definitely repeat the sentiments that we hope the best for his health, and that's the biggest thing in the long term. Jeff, appreciate you joining us this morning. We'll talk with you next week.
Yeah, as always, enjoy the rest of it, and go Canada, go.
Go Canada, go.
There we go.
There we go. Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks, guys.
Jeff Merrick, host of 32 Thoughts Podcast and the Jeff Merrick Show. It was, really hard to see that news about Chris Letang, and the original Penguins release is that he's not experiencing any lasting effects at this moment, and that they'll take some time to do the tests, and we definitely hope the best for him.
Terrifying. Definitely
very
terrifying.
Much.
Just repeat the sentiment. Hope things go well. Hope that he doesn't feel like he needs to play if he shouldn't play. Just hope for the best for him.
All right, it's time for something to chew on, brought to you by Great Canadian Meats.
Yum, yum, yum.
Stop me if you've heard this before. Tom Brady potentially returning to the Patriots?
Have we heard this before?
I don't know, but it's just Tom Brady moving around, doing this, putting himself in headlines. That's kind of the storyline.
Remember when we had sympathy? Well, we had sympathy for Tom.
For what he was going through, yes.
You know, we kind of felt bad. We didn't want to see the downfall. Now you know, okay, you're just opening yourself up for it now. Like, so, you go back to New England, doesn't work with you and Belichick. Like, you're just asking for trouble here.
You certainly
you're asking
are.
For it. What are you, 45 years old?
Yes. NFL insiders, and this isn't just some little bloggy blog thing. This is real. Insiders said that there is a significant truth behind the idea that he could return to the Patriots as pending free agent. Mac Jones would be traded in the scenario. And he could return back to the place that he never put in his tweet. Remember, he gave a lot of respect to X person, but not to the organization or Bill Belichick. And they're going to have more than $100 million in cap space.
Maybe I shouldn't go here, but I wonder if like the family influence is what brought him away from New England more than anything else.
Drama.
We thought it was like Belichick versus Brady. Mm. But this makes it seem like maybe it wasn't ever Belichick versus Brady. And like it's just like, okay, we want to be closer to home. That's home is Florida, I suppose, or was and continues to be. Maybe he's allowed to go to New England now. I don't know. It just seems like Tom also won this battle, too. He won the Brady-Belichick battle. So if you go back now, don't you kind of ruin that victory for yourself?
I don't know, man.
It really matters in the grand scheme of things. The Buccaneers are bad, and it's not because of the defense. It's because of Tom Brady and the offense. And now you want to go to New England, which has a great defense. But I don't know, man.
I just wonder the reception, too, because people were pissed off with the way that he left. And I can't believe he wouldn't give us respect.
But what are the 49ers
if you
want?
And now he's like, hey, I'm back.
The 49ers give you that one more chance. And that's your home. That's where he came from, California. That would be his hometown team. Jimmy G, you could embarrass him again, but it seems like, you know, maybe the 49ers can't win with Jimmy G, but they have everything else.
Nah.
The Patriots just doesn't seem like the move to me, unless it's just all about sentiment, and then I guess go for it.
Well, there's at least a small chance and something to chew on, most certainly. All right, we're going to take a break because we're calling Qatar. Peter Galindo up next. Canada going to be about 2.5 hours before kickoff here. I'm sure he's feeling the vibes, the energy. What's the mood like with the team? How can they make this a successful bookend to their World Cup before they host the next one? That's next on the Fan Morning Show. Peter Galindo.
Sportsnet 590. The Fan.
It's Baby Friday. Yesterday we talked about, let's just do it, Timbits, okay? How we were crushing Timbits during the break, and then we realized that Timbits do equal donuts when you eat enough. And I looked at the nutritional value, and we had eaten the equivalent of at least 2 donuts because Timbits just pop in there real quick, and you don't think about it.
Well, treat.
Boffo, who supplies Timbits every morning for us, just brought
not ever. We sound like divas that we have like a...
No, you're
what's
right.
That thing called? A runner? What is that called?
It's true, like a showrunner.
No, something when you... Like, let's say you're doing a show at a venue.
It's a runner.
No. And you... A rider?
Like whatever, you, a show
you,
hand.
Like, you want... Peanut M&M's.
We get it.
Peanut M&M's must be there.
Boffo is a lovely, generous soul, and he brings us Timbits every morning. He obviously caught us yesterday after...
Man, it's not every morning.
After we had the sad realization that they're not empty calories. Today, he brought us this box of 20 and put it down on the table, and we're like, oh, my God, Boffo, thank you. But also, I got to hit the gym. He opens up the box, and there's 3 apples in it.
Mm-hmm. And like 4 Timbits.
Yeah, just as like a charity for us. Like
it was a good move.
3 apples. We love it. I'm going to be eating one of those.
I'm also fired up. Yeah, I want the apple too. So Boffo's always got treats. He's always taking care of us.
But he also...
He's a great guy.
He heard us and he helped us with our dieting.
And through and through, he's a content guy.
Because
he gave us 2 minutes of content.
Incredible. Speaking of content.
Yeah, let's go to Doha. We got Peter Galindo on the line, who, of course, is at the World Cup for Sportsnet. And on the eve, 2.5 hours away, a little bit less from Canada's final match against Morocco. Let's start with that, like the mood, the feeling, what it's like preparing for a slightly, but still important, decentivized World Cup match for Canada.
That is a very good question, because, quite frankly, this game, in a lot of ways, based on how Canada has been discussing it in the build-up, you would not know that there's nothing to mathematically play for in terms of getting to the round of 16, just based on how they've talked. Because I think given how the first two games went, they're almost determined to make sure that at the very least their World Cup finishes on a high. Because everybody remembers that opening game against Belgium where they blew everybody away, neutrals and fans alike. Then they play Croatia. They have some moments, of course, but then they have a disastrous final 20 minutes of the first half where Croatia just turns the game on their head and punish Canada for being a little lackadaisical in some areas. And so currently the impression of this team is, well, which one are they? Are they the Belgium team or are they the Croatia team? So I think there's even more impetus on Canada alone to not only make history and get their first result or their first win at the World Cup, but also to, I think, prove to themselves, the fans and everybody else that, you know what, we're actually closer to that team that played Belgium than we are to that team that played Croatia. And we're going to prove it against a side that still has a lot to play for here.
This might be a little bit too broad, but how can either a win or a loss or a result or whatever happens help shape the next 4 years? Like, does it have real meaning on the next 4 years, the preparation, what it might mean for Herdman, what it might mean for the program? Like, are the stakes that high that what we think about this team and how this team is handled over the next 4 years could hinge on what we see today?
I think for the general public, it probably is important because, again, everybody remembers how you finish a World Cup, not necessarily how you start it. So I think that's one side of it. The other side of it, just in terms of what it could mean for the future of the program, look, they're not going to play a lot of marquee top-level teams from now until the World Cup starts because having qualified automatically as hosts, they don't have to go through World Cup qualifying. So you have the Gold Cup, the Nations League in CONCACAF, where, sure, you're going to play the U.S. and Mexico. And the U.S. has grown exponentially over the last couple of years as a team, but Mexico currently has fewer Tier 1 players than Canada does. And they're kind of experiencing a bit of an identity crisis themselves. So, you know, is that really going to be as much of a test as it traditionally would have been? That's the question. So all the more reason to go up against a top African team, or in the case of Belgium and Croatia, two of the traditional powers in Europe, because it's a barometer for these players in that this is kind of what you can expect at the absolute highest level. And it was interesting hearing Jonathan Osorio speak after the Croatia game, where he was explaining kind of how Croatia turned the game on its head. And he was saying that they actually didn't have any sort of coaching in terms of tweaking what was wrong with Croatia. They just did it. The players themselves just sort of talked to each other and said, all right, we need to do this, we need to do that. They put it into action. And then Osorio was saying that, you know, some of our players, and he wasn't saying this as a slight, he's just saying like they're inexperienced at this level. Some of the guys are young. Mm-hmm. They need John Herdman or other coaches to give them specific instructions on what to do to change strategy in game. So those little differences really make, well, a difference playing against teams like this, because then you learn what it's like to kind of adapt on the fly. You learn what the different quality is like. So that's what this game really means on a broader scale, because this is going to be the last time in this sort of setting for probably at least a couple of years that we're going to be able to see this team playing in matches like this.
It's perfect that you went with the inexperienced direction of that answer, because that's where we wanted to touch on next. We felt like there was kind of a humbling in terms of, A, the fan base being kind of inexperienced in terms of how to deal with this, certainly the players at times, but also with John Herdman and his off the pitch and on the pitch type of decisions and commentary and just dealing with the media. Did you feel the same way there, covering it live and being up in person with, you know, maybe just not understanding the world stage in a sense?
I think in terms of the off-field comments, I'm of the opinion that Herdman didn't really say anything wrong. Like, I mean, listen, coaches of any level are going to go out there and say, listen, let's go F them up or let's go do this and that to them. I guess his problem is he said it in public. And not only that, listen, I am friends with a lot of Croatians and Serbians. You do anything that could be deemed disrespectful to them, they are going to take it very personally. So maybe that was his one lesson. And he did admit he probably should have kept that comment to himself. But that's what this tournament is about, is that you do learn these little things. And then in terms of on the pitch, whether or not they got maybe humbled in a way, I think really what it showed us is more than anything else, when you fall asleep and you don't follow the little details, like tracking men, like having your shape not be compact enough defensively, which we saw in spades in those final 20 minutes of the first half, when you maybe take gambles on player fitness, because Atiba Hutchinson, 39 years old, on 3 days rest, going up against a Croatian midfield, and then Stefan Ostakio basically playing with one hamstring, maybe not the best strategy. But then on the flip side, you could argue, well, what was Herdman supposed to do? Because all of his other midfielders weren't really tested at that level. But again, it's all part of a learning experience. And I know it's easy to say this now, but trust me, guys, I do have receipts, whether it's on my podcast, whether it's in previous articles. I looked at the Belgium and Croatia games, and I identified Belgium as the more winnable one of the two, and Croatia was pretty much an automatic loss. And I feel a lot of people were looking at Croatia, and they saw 37-year-old Luka Modric and thought, oh, well, they're older, they're slower, like, they can be had. And I think that was a pretty humbling reminder that actually they're still pretty damn good.
When it comes to Herdman, how important or unimportant is he to this team in not just 2026, but getting to 2026? Like, is he indispensable? Do they need him? Do they suffer a big loss if he moves on? Can they be better if he's not around? What's your take on him in the future?
If they can get a coach like, say, a Carlo Ancelotti, who has expressed his interest in potentially coaching Canada one day, because he's married to a Canadian, she's from Vancouver, he spends his off seasons in Vancouver and whatnot. Unless you get a coach like him, I feel like Herdman is pretty much the most indispensable employee or player that the Canadian Soccer Association has right now. Because let's be honest, guys, they don't get to this stage without him. There was a lot of infighting. There was a lot of distrust. There was a lot of, really, in a word, it was kind of toxic in the men's program. And even before he took over the women's program, it wasn't looking great. And then he completely turned that around, and now he's done the same with the men. So, frankly, if it wasn't for him, I don't think we'd be even talking about any of this right now. So it is imperative he sticks around for 2026. The president of the Federation, Nick Bontis, was saying that that is going to be one of their top priorities, is maybe giving him an improved contract, because I do believe he's still under contract up until the 2026 World Cup, but he's the seventh lowest paid coach in the tournament. And he is very clearly, and I think deservedly, due a raise. And so I think that's going to be part of it. But also, if there's still going to be this labor dispute, if funds aren't going to be used to help improve all levels of Canadian soccer, whether that's the men's team, the women's team, the youth teams, what have you, maybe John Herdman looks at these other offers, sees the money that's being offered to him, sees the opportunity, and thinks, you know what, if I'm not getting what I need here, then I'm going to at least entertain these other offers. But based on what he said in his press conference yesterday, he is still committed at this point. And I think for Canadian soccer's sake, they better hope that he remains committed for the next three and a half years.
So the best case scenario then, after sort of everyone shows their inexperience but also shows their promise, is to just let this grow organically. Let these this four-year process play out, fund the four-year process, but stick to what got to them to this point.
I would say so. And I think another crucial task between now and 2026, and we're still seeing it over the last year or so, so like, we're definitely making progress in this regard, but getting more players into those high-level, high-pressure environments, right? When qualifying started, you probably only had about two, maybe three Tier 1 players, guys who were playing in the top leagues in the world or for big clubs in, say, Portugal, Belgium, who regularly qualify for the Champions League. Now there's six. Alistair Johnson's on his way to Celtic. Ismail Kone is probably going to move to a pretty big European club by the summer, probably even as early as January. So there's two more guys going over into those settings. The more players you can get in there, the better, because the only teams who have less Tier 1 players at this World Cup than Canada, I think all but one are knocked out, with the exception of Australia, and then Costa Rica is still alive. They could possibly go through. But pretty much there's a correlation between having as many Tier 1 players in your national team and being able to make progress. So, I mean, Canada, given just the amount that has happened over the last couple of years, I still think they're in a pretty decent spot. There are quite a few young players coming through. New dual nationals are popping up all over the place every day. I'm sure that they will be fine in that situation. But then the other side of it is they still have to get more matches against top-tier opponents. There are reports out there they might get invited to Copa America, which is the South American championship, so they might get to play Argentina, Brazil, teams
huge.
Like that. If that's the case, massive, exactly. So that has to be another task, is getting more games of this caliber to ensure that everybody is prepared in 4 years' time, so that maybe next time we're not talking about a consolation game in the third group match, we're maybe talking about them potentially going through in 2026.
So I'm reluctant to go here, but you're our guy, you're there. So I feel like we got to ask you about sort of the battle lines that seem to be drawn when it comes to Alphonso Davies and the kind of weird sudden referendum on his character and all that. It seems like those that are in Doha, whether they go really far, they go really deep on it, are kind of disappointed a little bit in Davies. And then everyone here, everyone in Canada, is defending Davies to the death. So where do you how has this thing sort of bubbled up? What's your take on it? And how should we feel?
Okay. Well, I'll try to be as nuanced as I possibly can, because there are a lot of layers to this. First and foremost, if Alphonso Davies, or any player for that matter, doesn't want to speak to us, that is their right. They are not responsible for speaking to us. And really, I don't think it has any bearing on the growth of Canadian soccer or the sport in general if the star player speaks to us or not. Maybe pulling back the curtain a little bit, I know you guys know this, but maybe some of the listeners might not. When reporters are a little upset that players don't speak, it's not because they themselves want these players to speak. It's the higher-ups above their higher-ups who are putting pressure on them to get these avails. So that is really what this stems from. But that being said, to question Alphonso Davies' character or his commitment, or you know, maybe possibly there being a fracture in the room, that is, maybe to put it bluntly, asinine. Because this guy, who I've covered since he was 15, 16 years old, he has been nothing but committed to this country. He has flown round trips from Munich to Aruba and Suriname and the Cayman Islands without any fuss. He gladly does it. He's accepted every call-up pretty much that he has been offered. And he has played in some pretty poor conditions and has put his body at risk to play for this country. So to think that he's a problem, I think, is definitely not really not cool, to be fair. And whether or not he speaks to us, I think that is moot. Really what is important to the growth of Canadian soccer, if we're talking about this, it's the Canadian soccer PR team, which is woefully understaffed, and the media working together to be able to produce quality stories so that fans, who new and hardcore, can continue to consume content of this team. They can stay informed. And you know what? Maybe then some of these other reporters, because having covered the team for a while, I have forged a few relationships with these players. A lot of them are shy, but the more comfortable they are with you, the more willing they are to open up. So if you can just build those relationships, if the PR team from the CSA maybe beefs up a little bit, becomes a bit more organized and works with us, I think then you won't see as many of these problems, because the one thing that has really hurt Canadian soccer over the years is all this infighting and scapegoating and general distrust. So if we can get rid of that, I think we'll be in a very good place in this regard, and then we won't be talking about stories like this.
Well, I'm glad you shut that down and gave us your perspective on that, because you would know best, and I agree. I don't think that the narrative has been maybe as accurately presented, especially all the way over here, so I'm glad to get that. So let's look forward today, Toronto. The Canadian soccer team has their final opportunity to make a bit of a statement here at the world stage. What are the problems that Morocco might present to Canada to do so?
Well, Morocco is, I think, like every other team, they all pose different challenges. When it comes to Morocco, their team defense is among the best in the tournaments. They are one of the stingiest teams. They haven't conceded a goal yet. Really, the key to that has been their defensive midfielder, Sofiane Amrabat, who is actually a doubt to play here. So if he doesn't end up starting, that's massive for Canada because he has been responsible in being able to shut down some counterattacking situations, generally being a shield in front of that defense. And they themselves have been quite disciplined defensively. But there is a way to kind of bypass that, I think, which kind of lies in the hands of Alphonso Davies and Tejon Buchanan here, in that both of Morocco's fullbacks like to push very high up the pitch. And that's probably one area Canada has to watch for defensively. But because they'll push so high up, there's tons of space to exploit in behind them. Belgium exposed us a few times, just couldn't get any clear shots at goal from it. Croatia, the one or two times they did counter on them, they had tons of space in behind. So if Canada can kind of get the ball in those wider areas, make runs in behind the fullbacks, they could probably end up getting some space here to maybe have a few opportunities to score.
So we know it won't be Canada winning the World Cup, but if you had to be a betting man, who is it in your perspective that does it?
Based on how the draw is shaping up, look, I picked Argentina to win the tournament at the start. Obviously, didn't begin too well for them, but they're starting to pick up steam. Now, it looks like they have a fairly clear shot to get right to a semifinal. And then from there, it really all comes down to, you know, in a sport of a lot of variances, just that one-off game. So I would say they have a shot. You know, France has kind of put all their injury problems behind them, and they still looking incredibly good, and they actually have a fairly clear path to a possible semi or a final. Maybe England could give them a challenge, but I'd still favor France. Those would be the two teams that immediately come to mind, but I mean, you also can't forget Brazil, always perennial favorites, defensively very sound. Neymar's coming back. I know he was hurt, but he'll be back possibly as soon as Cameroon tomorrow. And if that's the case, I would back them to probably make a deep run as well. So those would be the three teams that I'd look at as being the clear favorites for me.
Well, enjoy the rest of the tournament. Canada's final matchup today. We'll be tuning in at 10 a.m. here. Appreciate you joining us this morning, and enjoy.
Awesome. Thanks, guys. Enjoy the game.
As Peter Galindo's Sportsnet soccer writer in Qatar. This is it for Canada today, 10 a.m. against Morocco. All eyes on the way that they can bookend this tournament and look forward to 2026, where they're part of the co-host. And hopefully we can change the narratives that have kind of floated
around.
That
was the right take from him. I think that was measured. I think that was correct. But
nobody would know better than somebody that's been covering this team through it all.
Yep. And hopefully there's a lasting impression made today that we can focus on and come back to over the next 4 years.
And I
be cool if they got into that Copa America, I think you said, just like in a big tournament with other big teams. I would love to see them.
And I think we talked about this
they're
previously.
They're graduating out of the
CONCACAF teams
stuff. They don't even have to qualify. Like, you miss out on qualification is kind of important.
And it's an important time to put yourself up against the best. If you want to make a statement at the next World Cup, play against the hardest teams, learn from them, put yourself on that world stage. People are going to want to play you maybe now more because you've been at the World Cup. So an opportunity moving forward to play better competition. But that's the only way you get better.
It is a rider, by the way.
No, so, that's not right. People in the text line said it's a gopher. A gopher. Matt from Keswick said it's called a gopher, and then another texter said just the word gopher.
Interesting. Okay, so whether it's a rider or a gopher, if we had a live show somewhere, had a breakfast spot or something. Well, I guess we've had a live show.
We have had three live shows together.
No, but like, you know, audience live.
Oh, God.
And there's a green room. What do you demand is in there for you?
In the morning?
I guess good morning. We're a morning show.
I would like a big old fruit platter. Like, I want grapes, strawberries, raspberries, none of that cantaloupe garbage, watermelon slices, maybe some sliced peaches.
You know those beer vats that they put on your table and it's just like a...
Yep.
I don't know, like a mini keg. Not even a keg. It's just like a pipe.
Yep.
Where the beer goes down. I want that, but iced coffee.
Oh, that's good. Isn't it a beer tower?
Yeah, I guess it's a beer tower.
An iced coffee tower. Okay, so this is our perfect green room. A fruit platter for the ages and somebody feeding us grapes.
Like exotic, like a little exotic sort of
like
nature.
I would love a little papaya. Give me a mango.
Yes.
Give me something from down
Speak
south.
Speak to me, Ailish.
Like, I don't want the one from the grocery store here that's $14.99 and it's got...
No, they just rip through the pineapple and no one else touches anything.
Honeydew, pineapple, and maybe, if you're lucky, some sliced strawberries, but that's a rare occurrence, mm-hmm. which is honestly...
Depending on the time of year.
Outrageous price.
No, that's the worst.
I want a good old yummy exotic fruit platter and then this iced coffee vat.
Yeah, a vat of iced coffee.
What if you had an IV and it was just iced coffee right into your veins?
Probably health concerns.
All right. Two more texts in that it is a gopher. So I don't know. Big debate.
I've never heard that before, a gopher. But well, I could go for a gopher.
Oh, nice. All right. Next on the Fan Morning Show, we got Blake Murphy, host of Fan Drive Time, joining us. We're going to rip around all of the sports with him. That's next. Justin and Ailish on the Fan Morning Show.